I've discovered that it's really embarrassing and disempowering to be different. I've discovered that sympathy and understanding can halve the burden and that information helps in so many ways. There are a couple of quotes from my book, Doing Up Buttons, and my name's Christine Durham. I'd like to tell you my story. One sunny afternoon in late May, 16 years ago, I was absolutely thrilled to notice a patchwork quilt of colours on the autumn leaves on the hillside and the white bark of the gum tree in the school car park. I suppose I was thinking how wonderful, interesting and challenging my life was as I tossed my briefcase containing my nearly completed school reports on the back seat of the car. I drove out of the school car park. I just adored teaching. I'd taught at Ivanhoe Girls Grammar for the past 11 years, and I also had a passion for studying. I was doing my Masters of Education at Melbourne Uni. Our four children were late teenagers, and they were all wonderful, caring young adults who were in turn enjoying their own study. As I left my classroom that afternoon, my eye caught a postcard I'd sent to my students from Mexico just a couple of weeks previously. My husband, Ten, and I had had fantastic adventures after a conference on philosophy for children, where I'd spoken at Mexico City. Wow, this is a fabulous time of my life. I'll finish my master's, I'll finish my book about thinking my career's going to fly now. It's time for me, I thought. Bang. In a split second, my life was changed from BA, before accident, and AA, after accident. A gentleman coming out a side street had swiped the back of my car, spun me round, and a telegraph pole stopped my flight. I had about 42 breaks in my ribs, a fractured clavicle. I'd choked on the seatbelt, so it was a bit like a stroke. My left side didn't work at all. It was clenched. In the end, I only had two fingers that worked on my right side. I was out of my mind in agony. As well as these injuries, I was later to learn that I also had a fractured skull and brain injury. I had spooky double vision and no words to express the two-headed monsters that emerged out of the darkness in the intensive care unit. Later, when I'd been moved from the intensive care unit into the chaos of a noisy 8-bed ward, I slowly realised that I didn't know my own name. I didn't know where my mouth was to feed myself. And anyway, my hand didn't obey me to get food into my mouth. I choked on the food too. I'd forgotten how to swallow automatically. When they got me out of bed to walk, I couldn't walk straight, or rather, I'd walk straight into doors or into walls. I was pretty crook. So from flying high, I was totally grounded. And I'd also totally lost me. But when I was unconscious, I went down that long tunnel into the light and I had a vision. I came out of that with the most amazing thought that the most important thing we own are our own thoughts. That meant that the secret of me recapturing my life was thinking. I had to discover the secret of thinking. I had a great dad and I was like a child again, and I suppose Dad's words floated into my mind. One thing he'd say was, "Chick, nil desperandum, never give up hope." Another thing he'd say to me, "Chick, a problem stated is a problem solved." I acted on these words as I started to resume life at a crawl. I still had a tiny flicker of hope burning, the belief that thinking was the secret, and the more the experts tried to tell me that I was finished, that meant that I had an even greater determination to try and find a way to recapture my life. There did seem no way out. I was trapped in a body that wouldn't obey me. I was trapped by pain and trauma and brain injury, confusion. My words had gone. I didn't understand. I couldn't communicate. Yet in my head, wry thoughts kept flashing. For example, when they tried to force me to breathe and they said otherwise they'd have to do a tracheotomy and I wouldn't like that, in my head I joked to myself, "But this isn't much fun either." Being not myself, I didn't know who I was, what day it was. I'd wake up in a panic, and then when I couldn't walk, talk or think properly or find my mouth, I was absolutely devastated. Many months later, as I made my way to doctor's appointments, traffic lights meant in my brain, drop your handbag. At home, I didn't know where the light switch was or the tap in the garden. So it was very complex trying to negotiate life when I was me or not me. When I left hospital, they said I should go to rehab. I didn't know what rehab was. I thought the only people who went to rehab were soldiers. I knew I wasn't a soldier, so they must all be crazy, I thought. When after many months at home I eventually went to rehab, I couldn't understand what was happening. One day I even ganged up with my bikey mates against the physios because we couldn't understand what was going on. People hadn't given us a reason for doing what we were. Brain injury was not explained, so I couldn't understand. I felt I was mad, and I had to hide it or I'd be locked up. All this time I was constantly trying to make sense of things. I'd also lost confidence in myself and in the whole world from being dependable. Slowly, with my one finger that worked, I tapped away on the computer. And after 5 years, I said to my husband, I've written a book. And he said, no, you haven't. I said, yes, I have. And I gave it to a literary agent. Within a week, Penguin had signed me up. And then my book came out. And that's led to a whole wonderful career of talking to people about what it's like to have your life changed. Thinking back, I was very fortunate because I continued on with my study. And also I continued on struggling to get back to school. I ended up just teaching half a day a week and I taught philosophy or thinkings to students. And I've run 4,000 thinking workshops, so I have been able to try and discover some of the secrets of thinking. And I did continue on with my master's and I finished it. Because in having my car accident on the way to uni, it all seemed in vain if I didn't continue what I was doing then. I suppose thinking about it, or trying to pigeonhole all the issues involved, to go back to study after my brain injury, I needed huge motivation, and I also needed an interest and a determination. The determination I had, but it was very hard, feeling so flat and dull, to find an interest. I suppose I wanted to get my master's also to prove that I was still employable and to keep my job. I found it very difficult. I had to really focus on my study. It became a priority in my life. I had to really try hard. The first night I went back to uni, my dear husband Ted had to take me by the arm, lead me to a desk, pull out a stool, sit me on the stool and put a pencil in my fingers. And the lecture went through and I didn't understand one word. It could have been in Dutch or something. My children would take me each week to lectures. And eventually, after 3 or 4 weeks, I understood a little bit. So education became my rehabilitation. Study also gave me something to do to focus on. So my time of not being able to work full time had an aim. And I had something that was really worthwhile to concentrate on. I worked really solidly. I had to get the assignments finished well before the due date so I could review them. I wrote notes down before I spoke to my lecturers and supervisors. And it was very, very handy to have notes which I could blow up on the computer to large print so I could read them and highlight them and read them again. And waiting in doctor's surgeries or for physios, it was wonderful to pull out a bundle of notes and go through them and make some notes. So study for me gave my life purpose and meaning. It was good because I managed to select subjects at that time that were familiar to me from previous study I'd done. If I try and find the feelings, because what I'm working through with you now is some of my handy thinking, which I wrote about in my second book called Chasing Ideas, and Edward de Bono did the blurb for that, so I think it's rather ironic that someone with brain injury can get such a great thinker to endorse their book. And in this book, I developed using your fingers as tools to help you think. And if you're studying, it really does help. Your thumb stands for pigeonhole it or find out all the issues it's like, and then you can start to work out how you've solved other issues. Your pointer finger tells you to find the facts and look for all the facts, and that was what I was doing a moment ago. and your middle finger's in the middle of your hand like your heart's in the middle of your body, and that reminds you to find the feelings. And some of the feelings about the challenge of studying with my ABI was the whole experience was very, very challenging. It was moving me out of my comfort zone, so it was really good for me. But I saw it as something I could work towards. I saw the study problems as issues that I could try and solve and problem solve and think about, even working out how to get to lectures, being driven by my family, working out how I could understand, how I could take notes because my spelling was atrocious and my writing wasn't much good either. Researching, planning assignments, writing assignments were really hard, and delivering class papers were almost impossible because I couldn't speak very well. But I discovered, being a little bit inventive, that you can use symbols to remind you of things, and that can help when you can't see very well. I've still got double vision, so I couldn't see very well to read notes, but using objects really helped me. After some time, starting to understand more was really, really exciting, and my interest and my passion grew and grew, and it became a wonderful, wonderful, rewarding thing. And when I stood up on that stage to get my piece of paper, it felt fantastic because everyone had told me I couldn't do it. So I suppose if I want to judge what it was like trying to return to study, which everyone told me not to, if I look at the good, bad and curious things, it's quite interesting. Reiterating some of the things I've said before, but looking at the good things, it gave me something normal to do. It was a huge boost to my self-esteem. I was able to prove the experts wrong. I could do it. And it was very interesting to think that it was just a really worthwhile anchor in my week that could help me feel normal. I found ways to make the most of my educational opportunities in the whole experience. Even being out amongst people and talking to people was wonderful rather than if I just stayed at home. And I sure learnt a lot more about life. I learnt a lot more about teaching. And of course, most importantly, I learnt a lot more about myself. Some of the bad things when I think back on it about studying with my brain injury was it took up an enormous amount of energy. The whole thing was pretty scary. Even being out of the house and getting into a car to go to uni felt like playing Russian roulette to me. The car was like a loaded gun. It took me a lot of time to develop new tricks to help myself study. There was so much to do, and at times I felt isolated, frustrated, and I lost confidence in myself because what was easy to everyone else was such an effort to me. I'm also interested that there's a real stigma of having a disability, and university or lecturers back then, 16 years ago, didn't always understand the complexities of trying to study with ABI. In those days, there was no one to help me or no one to lead the way or no one to give me suggestions. Some of the curious things about studying with my brain injury was, first of all, it was a marvellous opportunity to meet new people. There was no one to give me any tips. But at the end of it all, I had something concrete to prove that those years weren't lost. Unfortunately, now I know, because of my ABI, I could never return to full-time classroom teaching. I suppose if I'd known this at the time, I wouldn't have pushed myself to study, so it's both good and bad. But because of my brain injury, I had to find another door. I continued on at school teaching philosophy and thinking for 11 years and ran 4,000 thinking workshops with students, and I developed my handy thinking tools and rose chasing ideas, and I've also contributed to educational books, so I never would have done any of that if I hadn't continued studying. And because I'd studied, I'd realised I could still write. So our little finger, if we wanted it to be like the other fingers, it'd need to grow. It'd need growth. And for me, growth stands for great, original, wise thinking. And to do that, just try and get some overview, I ask myself what if. What would have helped me study with my ABI? What if I'd had information about other people studying with ABI? If only I knew I was not alone, it would have been not as scary as it was. What if it had information such as this CD to give me tips and hear about other people's stories? What if I'd had a structure and suggestions to help me, something such as my handy thinking, which would help me organise my thoughts and try and work on projects? What if I'd known that study would open other doors to amazingly exciting opportunities for writing and speaking? Back then, what if I'd made my difficulties into challenges? I suppose all the time I was trying, edging to do that. What if I'd used handy thinking to organise issues and problems? And I suppose an important what if is to, if only then I'd realised that sometimes I twist the truth and I have filters that distort. And I take things personally and I blame myself. If only I'd realised I wasn't always seeing the truth. What if I'd recognised my problem-solving strategies and I'd been able to find new strategies? I suppose my journey over the last 16 years has led me to a discovery. I've discovered that we can find ways to do up our buttons and to put our lives together. And we can do it. I'd like to read to you from my book, Doing Up Buttons, my account of what it was like. And the chapter I'd like to read you is Uni, Trying to Find Me. I had a one-track mind. I decided that if I could get back to uni and work on my master's degree, I'd find the old me. I just had to try and do it. After much soul-searching and working out of practicalities, who'd take me and pick me up, we all decided I should try to continue my degree. In a way, all of us felt that my pain and suffering would have been in vain if I gave up. Somehow to continue seemed a positive, active step in thwarting the man who'd hit me and preventing him from ruining my life. In hindsight, my first night of lectures alone was crazy. The trip to uni terrified me. Ted took me, helped me find the lecture room, sat me in a seat and, bless his heart, stayed and took notes for me. Ken, Helen, Anne each volunteered to accompany and help me. The subject was a continuation of the Futures in Education course I'd completed in the summer school at the beginning of the year. There was a weekly two-hour lecture. Rick, the lecturer, was most supportive and helpful. My peers were kind. At first I felt as if the lecture was conducted in a foreign language. I certainly couldn't understand a word of what he was saying. Rick ran the classes by giving notes to read at home before the lecture. The kids read to them, read them to me, but they made no sense, and after several weeks of perseverance and discussions with Ken and Anne and Helen about the topic, I started to understand a little. Ted increased the size of the type of the notes, and I used a ruler and a finger to slowly follow each line and repeated the facts out loud. Gradually I understood fragments of what Rick was talking about, how excited I felt when I could grasp the meaning of a sentence. This was working. By working hard, I was convinced I could improve. Slowly, slowly, I could try and recapture this section of my life. The subject I was taking was a sequel to one I'd taken just before the accident, and this meant the content and much of the terminology was familiar. In the past, I'd typed all of my projects, but the boys felt a computer would help. It did. The computer meant that I could slowly make notes in big print, and it became possible for ideas to come out via my fingers onto the keyboard, when it would have been very hard to say or read the words. It was so interesting. I couldn't understand a novel, but to study a familiar subject was possible with heaps of help and encouragement from my family. At times I'd record ideas onto a tape as I lay in bed and the kids would type them up. Study certainly provided an activity I could do on my own pace when I felt well enough. Even if it was just 10 minutes a day, I felt as if I was achieving something. If I had time to spend waiting for an appointment with the physio or the doctor, I'd pull out a page or two of notes and a marker. Tutorials were another thing altogether. They were a huge challenge because I had such trouble reading out loud. My memory was so poor. I could have read the same paragraph over and over again and not realised I'd just read it. Placing my finger on each word helped, but was rather slow and ungainly for presenting a uni paper. So I found things that could become my cues and help me speak. I thought of using several different boxes or chests with matches or chess pieces in them to get a message across. Pictures and symbols and charts, written by my daughter, spoke to me and my audience much more than words, and of course this meant that Ken or Anne had to get me and my bag of tricks to and from uni. Uni was a wonderful measure with which to gauge my progress. We graduated from Ted having to take me by the hand and physically put me in a chair and a pencil in my hand, to Ken supporting my weight as we fumbled our way to lectures, and Anne leading me across the road. Then came the day when she waited and watched in the car, heart in her mouth, while I crossed the road on my own. Later, she said she felt just like I must have felt watching her learn to cross the road in primary school. Talk about role reversal.